Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Spech.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
I'm back.
You're back from your motorcycle trip.
Oui.
You went east?
La Belle Provence.
Good time?
It was. It was a good time.
Great weather?
We had a bunch of rain at the first of the trip, and then a bunch of rain the last night of the trip. So, but other than that, it was really good weather. In some cases, it was really hot weather, but if you're down by the St. Lawrence, it's nice and cool.
Good.
We saw a lot of people. It was in St. Paul Bay or something. Anyways, a lot of kayakers out there, paddleboarders, people on the beach. It was a nice area.
Tis the season.
Yep. It was pretty cool. There. Yeah. It was very nice. A good trip.
And then you had to come home.
I know.
Go back to work.
And catch up on my work because nobody does my work for me while I'm gone.
There's no good mix. You figure the money you pay them.
I know.
Yeah, not much been happening around here. Had a couple of things going, but yeah, nothing. A lot of yard work this year, it seems.
Yeah, I'm finding it especially. Like, I think we're just getting into it this year, and there's been a especially large amount because I've been letting random trees grow in the backyard and stuff. So it's like,
God, yeah,
I have a forest going on back there. I got to do something with that.
I'm thinking if I just get rid of all my vegetation.
Yes.
Maybe like pave my backyard, the front yard, mow down all the trees.
Yeah.
It'll make things a lot easier.
Put in that fake outdoor carpet, green carpet.
Oh, yeah. That'd be awesome.
You don't ever have to mow that stuff.
The fake turf.
Yeah.
That you put outside your trailer when you're at the campground.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. That'd be awesome.
It would be. You don't have to mow it.
I could just go through the motions of mowing.
Yes. Just roll it. You don't even have to start it up.
Roll it back and forth.
His lawnmower is very quiet.
Let's do one of these new whisper light lawnmowers. I'll just walk around. Throw the occasional rock. Oh, I hit something.
We have a patio area in the back of our yard where our patio couches and chairs are, and we have one of those fake carpets. And it's actually grown a few weeds. I have to pluck the weeds out. It's like, what the heck? You're not allowed there, buddy.
Are they fake weeds?
No, they're real weeds. So I had to pluck some weeds out. It was like,
real weeds out of the fake grass.
Yeah. You are not allowed to grow there.
Wow, what's this world coming to?
Yeah. I was vacuuming at a time when I saw the weeds. I was vacuuming my fake carpet.
we're just doing lots of... we have people that like to keep giving us plants and...
Oh.
No. You know what? You can garden your own house.
Yeah.
Well, how many plants do you want this year? None. We're ripping everything out. We're redoing stuff properly because people just keep putting stuff all willy-nilly.
I'm putting in plastic plants on my outdoor flower bed.
Right? I think I'm going to go with something like a coconut tree or something.
Yeah.
I got that pineapple plant in the house that I've been growing for 4 years now.
That won't survive outside.
It won't survive outside, and it's pretty much not going to survive in here any longer.
Oh, yeah?
It's supposed to have this little pineapple thingy come up.
Didn't you have one at one time?
No, that was the...
Avocado.
Avocado. Ah. But this is like you get roots on the bottom of the top of a pineapple plant and you plant it.
I've tried it a few times. I've failed every time.
Oh, my... It's a massive plant.
Yeah.
All the spiky thingies that come out.
Yeah.
But they're supposed to be up from the middle. It's supposed to come a decorative pineapple sort of thing.
I would say decorative. If it was in a proper greenhouse, you'd probably grow a full-size pineapple.
That's why I'm saying decorative. Yeah. So, but nothing. Zero. These big, long, spiky things are probably like 3-4 feet.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, this thing's done. It's going. Bye-bye. When we have guests come over, we have to, like for dinner, we have to move it to another room.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's just so big.
Table.
Yeah, we put it in the middle. Oh, here we have this nice plant in the middle of our table. Where's the table? All I see is plant.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, no. So that's what we're doing right now. It's just doing a ton of gardening.
Mm-hmm.
But I am off a couple days this week, so.
Oh, right on.
Probably get out in the boat at some point.
Perfect.
And do some paddling, because it's been a couple weeks since I've been out paddling. You ever been to Washington, D.C.?
No.
Why not?
I don't think I've even flown over or around it.
Do you know where it is?
I could find it on a map.
Really?
I could.
Well, you're one step ahead of me. You know the Potomac River?
Potomac? Yeah.
Potato, potato?
Yeah. I remember seeing a documentary on an airplane crash that hit a bridge and went into the Potomac. It's famous from 76? Anyways, late 70s. What about it? What about the Potomac?
The section that flows from the nation's capital is considered one of the best urban paddling trails in America.
Urban paddling trail.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. East Coast Waterway is also well known for its historical sites, smaller riverside communities with outdoor dining, you had me there, and islands with hiking trails and rushing waterfalls. But many are unaware that it's in jeopardy. In a report, the conservation organization American Rivers ranked it first on the list of the country's most endangered rivers.
Hmm.
Nonprofit group which works to protect and restore rivers has released its annual list of America's most endangered rivers.
Did you get a list of the other ones? What other rivers do you recall?
No, I'm just checking this one out. Just this one. Yeah. Just I want to know about number one.
Mm-hmm.
The Potomac River takes the lead in the latest roundup due in part to pollution. That always seems to be the big thing is the pollution.
Yeah, it's the main killer. It's the industry or the public mm-hmm. or whatever.
But here's why I'm concentrating on this one. There's also a newer factor at play. And this has come up a lot.
Oh, this is lately. Big lately, yes.
The proliferation of data centers along the waterway. These big, massive data centers. Since AI has started coming out big time, the data centers aren't... It's not like the little centers you'd have your, you know, the cloud.
Yeah.
These are massive.
And apparently they take up...
Acres.
But the power usage is... They will take up more power than the area and communities that mm-hmm. they're going to be built in. But the main concern is how much water throughput. Like, they're changing their... Like, the water's not coming out dirty. It's just coming out hotter.
Mm-hmm.
So they're using a lot of water, and it's gonna change the environment around these data centers because it's taking
of the water that actually comes out.
Yeah, the way yes.
Yeah. So as of March 2026, the Potomac Basin has the largest concentration of data centers in the world.
Wow.
Per the Interstate Commission on the Potomac River Basin. So what's the problem with data centers using the river's water, and what's at stake for travelers? Data centers may impact water quality and supply. They could cause environmental issues downstream. They could be a problem for local residents and visitors alike in the event of a summer drought. Could take many some activities along the river less pleasant, from kayaking around shipwrecks at a fascinating Maryland Marine Sanctuary at Mallows Bay to dining with river views on the Georgetown waterfront. What are the best ways to enjoy? And how can you help protect it? That's the big thing that they're trying to get out there now. Obvious place to start is Washington, D.C., where you can rent a kayak at the District Wharf, get out on the water on a group tour, self-guided adventures. Georgetown, you can go for a hike. Part of the C&O Canal towpath, historic 184.5-mile trail that runs parallel to the river, extending all the way to Cumberland, Maryland. Then you can dine with water views at Founding Farmers, Fishers, and Bakers, lively indoor-outdoor eatery in Washington Harbor. So the whole thing is get out there and enjoy the waterway, make it used, make people see that it is being used on a big basis.
Yeah, after you go to see your UFC fight and watch mm-hmm. the Nitro Circus motorcycles do flips and turns, you can go and kayak the river and check things out, and nice dinner out on the town. Yeah, good plan.
Outside the city, hike or bike near the river while exploring the Potomac Heritage National Scenic Trail, which is a scenic hiking trail that snakes through Washington, D.C. to West Virginia. Visit Seneca Regional Park, Virginia's tucked away park on the Potomac, with serene vibes and hiking trails. Head to the walkable Old Town Alexandria other Virginia city on the Potomac River that's known for excellent waterfront restaurants. Nearby, you can rent a kayak, canoe, stand-up paddleboard at Bellhaven Marina, just south of Old Town Alexandria, to get on the different section of the river. Again, to use the river and let it be known this is being used. Support American Rivers Campaign to Protect the Potomac. You can take action by filling out a simple form on the organization's website. It's attached to a personalized letter asking Congress to reauthorize the Clean Water and Drinking Water State Revolving Fund Bill. Clean Water and Drinking Water State Revolving Fund Bill and the Sewer Overflow and Stormwater Reuse Municipal Grant Program before they expire in September 2026.
Let me change that into an acronym. The CWDWSRFSOSRMG
program. Wowzers. So go to American Rivers website and find all that information there on how to help protect the Potomac. Many data centers obtain water from municipal ground well water wells. So this is why data centers are potentially harmful to our waterways. And they get their water, some obtain it directly from aquifers. Heavy pumping can lower groundwater levels, particularly in drought-prone or heavily developed regions, because you got the communities already taking that groundwater for their drinking water.
Yep.
Now you add one of these big data centers.
And just as a side, it's like NASA does have satellites that measure ground slump due to reduction in groundwater supplies, and they can measure millimeter drops. And so they're seeing half inch, 3 inch, 10 inch drops of surface areas because of groundwater, depending on what state or what location, like the groundwater removal is causing slumps.
Yeah. It's pretty scary here.
Mm-hmm.
Potential consequences include reducing drinking water availability, lower water tables for private wells, reduced stream flow connected to groundwater. Groundwater quality issues. The data center cooling systems often use chemical additives to prevent corrosion, scaling, and the growth of algae and bacteria. Common additives may include anti-corrosion scaling chemicals, biocides, chlorine compounds, glycols, and so forth. Additionally, some non-water liquid coolants may contain refrigerants and PFAs, also known as forever chemicals, requiring special forms of treatment. Fluorinated gases may also be used for air cooling. PFAs have negative health impacts and are difficult to remove. If leaks, spills, or improper wastewater disposal occur, contaminants may either enter the soil or the groundwater systems or both. EPA guidance notes that cooling system blow down water can contain chemicals that may require permits or wastewater treatment before discharge. Blow down water is the water that's removed from a cooling system to prevent the buildup of mineral scale and so on. So any water that they use that's being dumped back in may contain these chemicals.
A lot of chemicals, right? A lot of debris, a lot of, yeah, there's a lot of entrained stuff that's going to come out.
Mm-hmm. Which, if it heads back into the water, it's warming up the water.
It's warming up the water, but it's also adding chemicals because you have to protect the piping and systems and the heat exchangers, so you want to prevent any buildups and whatever. Like, if you're on one of the Great Lakes, you obviously have to treat the water that's going through to prevent, like, zebra mussels from forming inside your heat exchangers and coolers and whatever. So there's chemicals, chlorines, and whatever that are treated. So you put that into a municipal supply? Like in a
In a river that's being used for recreation.
Yeah. Well, like it's recreation, drinking water, and whatever. Like, man, it's one of those things. It's like, you know, even here in Toronto, if there's a major storm, the Don Valley, the sewer systems that are there are going to overflow, and then the next day it's like, hey, nice day, the storm's gone. It's like you go out there and you're floating amongst all the sewage, right?
Yep.
So.
All the stuff gets washed off the roads into the sewer systems.
That's, you know, it just occurred to me.
Uh-oh.
I never thought, I'm going to go paddle, but I better clean my paddles and my hull when I'm done, because there's going to be human fecal matter all over the bottom of it because there was a washover in the Don Valley in the basin and whatever. It's like, you never think about that.
But
it's
like,
I know. Don't dump.
We're going out to do some kayak roll practice today.
Hey, do you have pink eye?
Yeah.
Not yet, but I will.
Right?
Yeah, it's one of those things you don't really think about. Like when in the summers when they have these closed down Cherry Beach and whatever locally here, like it's all closed down because usually Canada geese are pooping on the beaches and it's washing in. Bacteria counts get really high, or there's some storm reason where, you know, some sewage system gets overborne. You get out there paddling in this stuff and you don't really, it's...
Well, look at...
It's disturbing to think about what you could be swimming in if you dump your kayak.
What about the Collingwood Beach last year that they ended up closing because they found so many people were actually digging cat holes in the beach?
That was...
Was that not Collingwood?
No, that was... Oh, shoot.
It was up that way, though, was it not?
Yeah, it was...
Midland or...
No, it's the big famous beach. It's huge.
Sauble
Beach.
Oh, now there's so many beaches up there. But that's the same deal. Yeah. Like, you close the beach because you're finding people are...
Pooping
in a hole and covering it up on the beach. Yeah. Who does that?
Hey, I'm on a beach, and nobody can see what I'm doing.
Yeah, nobody can see what I'm doing underneath my little sun canopy. Was it not Sauble Beach?
No.
And it wasn't Collingwood. Yeah, because Collingwood's a town. It's not the beach.
Wasaga Beach.
There we go. I knew there was one up there.
It's become a huge problem at Wasaga Beach. People, it's like, you're not a cat. Don't poop in the sand.
Right?
Anyway. It's water quality and it's human health hazards. And it's
So now you add in these chemicals from a data center.
I know, yeah.
Some data centers draw water directly from rivers, lakes, and reservoirs. Large withdrawals may reduce stream flow during droughts, affect aquatic habitats, increase competition with agriculture and municipal users, and alter seasonal water availability. These concerns are also important during a drought. Especially, I mean, yeah. Do you want that data center so somebody can make a GPT chat thing?
Yeah.
Or do you want some drinking water?
Exactly. Well, what's more important, right?
Or do you want to water your field so that we can grow food?
Well, then there's another, that brings another problem is because when you're watering fields, there's a lot of phosphates and whatever from fertilizers that run off. Like farming does cause a lot of pollution as well. And you don't,
but you need the water.
You need the water to water the fields.
Yeah. If you want to pollute a river, you need the water to get in those fields to pollute that river.
Yeah. it's a compounding issue. It's hard to get away with it. But the problem is these data centers are just huge, massive amounts of water, and there's the potential for the outflow and effluent to be contaminated with whatever chemicals are they putting through their systems.
Yep.
It's like...
Then there's the thermal pollution of the surface waters.
And that's the initial one that I was concerned about. It's like you're changing the water temperature.
After circulating through cooling systems, water may be discharged back into surface waters at higher temperatures. Warmer discharge water can reduce
more algae.
Dissolved oxygen levels,
stress
fish and aquatic organisms, promote algae blooms, cause long-term changes to aquatic ecosystems. Environmental organizations and researchers have warned that the thermal discharges from cooling systems could harm ecosystems if not carefully managed. And then there's the chemical discharge.
Yeah.
Cooling tower blowdown water may contain salts and minerals, corrosion scaling inhibitors, biocides, heavy metals from piping systems, refrigerants, PFAS chemicals. If inadequately treated, these discharges could affect downstream water quality and aquatic life. United States, under the Clean Water Act, facilities that discharge wastewater directly into waterways may require permits under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System.
NPDES. They don't even try to make acronyms out of them.
Right? You got to say that every time.
Yeah.
I'd be the guy that's making something that, like, spells Fred.
People do that.
Something like that, right? So, yeah, so all this stuff going into the data centers, you know, they're building these centers close to waterways to have that access to cooler water to help cool their systems down. Becomes a coin flip. Do you want the data or do you want the environment and drinkable water?
Well, yeah, so we always focus on, this is our job. Well, that's not a job, but this is our thing. We talk about paddling and
yeah,
you know, we want to protect the paddles and the water, the paddling surfaces, the waterways, the rivers, lakes, streams, whatever.
The environment.
Because this is what we do for recreationally, but really it covers so many different aspects when it comes to just common pollutants. And it's like, it's been seen now that with PFAS, like we're seeing now that people have plastic particles in their bones now. Mm-hmm. It's like, are we winning yet? Like, you know what I mean? But, like, obviously we try to focus on the paddling aspect of it, but we can't help but tip out into other aspects, which is our consumables. Like, we have to drink this water. This is our water. And so even if it goes through water treatment plants, there's still PFAS going into our drinking systems, and you can't get away from it. It's in our food. It's in our water.
Well, it also brings into effect, like, when you look at your water filter you take on a canoe trip, they're supposed to filter out a ton of stuff. But how many things are in these waterways now that we have no clue that our filters we've been using for the last 5-10 years are not catching?
Yeah.
And going into our systems.
Uh-huh.
Because they're not on the radar yet.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Hmm. Yeah, it's a mess. So, like, I remember not even 10, 15 years ago, there was a lot of studies going on, and, like, National Geographic was trying to get blood samples for people from all continents and countries and whatever, because they wanted a worldwide map of what's in our bodies, right? And with a lot of investigator stuff, they can say, well, we can tell that you were born and raised in this section of Canada or in this section of the province, in this section of wherever, because we can see that your hair growth over time. We can analyze the 6 inches of hair that's on your head. And we can see that, oh, you spent a lot of time in, say, for example, the Toronto area, because we can recognize the chemical compounds that came out and grew mm-hmm. into your hair.
Or, not mine.
Well, yeah, it's so obvious, but they can take your beard hair. Right? They can take your beard hair.
They can, like, try.
But yeah, so there's what they're saying is that there's signatures that's in our hair and bones, fingernails and so mm-hmm. on, that we can, there's a signature, almost like a fingerprint of where you live for a series of years.
That's just like a tree.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When they cut into a tree.
They can say, oh yeah, this chair, back in 1847, there was a major forest fire. We can see indications of that. Or, you know, in the late 1800s, in the mini ice age, we could see that there was tiny, tiny growth rings because it was very cold in that period and whatnot, right? So they can see these indicators, but they can also see it in the human body and what we're putting out in the environment.
Yeah.
And if we go, depending on where... around full circle, if we go for a paddle, we go through something and you put the canoe or kayak back on the roof, it's like, oh, there's a stain on the bottom of my canoe. What did I paddle through?
Mm-hmm.
And then you try and clean it. It's like, why is that not coming out of the fiberglass? Right? Or Kevlar or whatever.
Or what have you.
It's stained and it's like, oh, no. So we're doing a lot of stuff and these data centers are not helping.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, how many times you hear, well, back in the day, we didn't know. Well, we are right now back in the day.
Yeah, and now we
and
do know.
15, 20 years from now, people are going to be going, well, back in the day in the year 2026, we didn't know about.
Yeah, but there's a lot of stuff that we do know about, yeah. And we're not doing anything about it. People go, oh, there's bigger fish to fry. It's like, whoa, you know what? Give us 20, 30 years and there's going to be massive fish to fry that we could have done something about in
massive
the time.
Fish with three eyes, yeah, and exactly. Arms.
They call that fish Blinky on the Simpsons.
Blinky on the systems, Blinky. Yeah. So as much as everybody wants this AI and everything else, it comes at a cost.
Well, who does want AI, though?
Not me. I only want AI for the humor. Because there are some pretty good jokes out there that are done with AI.
Yeah, yeah.
But writing books and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. You know what? If you can't write a book on your own, you shouldn't be an author.
Yeah. Yeah. If you can't write it without AI. So, anyway. Father's Day's coming.
It is. I heard a rumor.
I heard a rumor Father's Day's coming. And you're getting socks and underwear. Just like at Christmas when you were a kid. Yeah. So, I get these emails from Gear Junkie. And this came up in one of the latest ones. If you're looking for a practical Father's Day gift for the outdoorsman in your life, the Saber Frontiersman Max 7.9 ounce bear and mountain lion spray with belt and holster is a safety essential for hikers, campers, anglers, and anyone who spends time in the backcountry. I've heard of bear spray. I think I got a can around here.
It's a big name for bear spray.
But mountain lion spray.
Yeah. BC is big. Well, I don't want to say big. It's like it's common. There's a lot of mountain.
Yeah, but I've never heard of bear and mountain lion spray.
Yeah.
Wildlife encounters can happen in unexpected places, especially during summer when animals seek shade and water near trails and campsites. Compact and easy to carry, this spray offers added peace of mind for outdoor adventures, whether dad is exploring familiar trails or venturing somewhere new. Or getting in a fight with the neighbor. Don't think I have ever heard of mountain lion spray. Like I say, I've always heard of bear spray. Yeah, you bring a bear spray, bear bangers, stuff to scare the bear away. Well, what about the mountain lions? When did they show up? Maximum stopping power, Saber Frontiersman Max, the only EPA registered spray for bears and mountain lions. Made with 2% major capsaicinoids. Capsaicinoids. The strongest formula allowed by law. Backed by our industry-exclusive in-house HPLC lab, guaranteeing max strength in each canister. Protection at safe distance with a 40-foot, 12-meter spray range reaching up to 20 feet further than the competition. Frontiersman Max Bear and Mountain Lion Spray gives you more time to react to a bear or mountain lion, charging up to 35 miles per hour with a 6 to 7 seconds of total spray time. Immediately accessible bear spray. Easy to access when seconds count. This bear and mountain lion spray includes a quick draw belt holster for secure carry. Strong elastic keeps bear spray secure while out on the trails. Glow-in-the-dark safety for easier location in the dark. So when you got it in your tent at night and a bear trying to knock, hello?
Hello, anybody in there? I'm looking for you look like a burrito. You look like a burrito in there.
Quiet and quick access to the protection. Hook and loop sound could aggravate a threatening bear and potentially cause aggressive behavior. Frontiersman holster eliminates that unnecessary hook and loop, aka Velcro strap, allowing for quick and silent access to your spray during an emergency. Rigorously tested to maximize your safety. EPA and Health Canada approved, but you can't get it here from what I'm understanding.
So I'm looking at it. It's available. I'm shopping for it right now, actually.
Yeah.
Canadian Tire has it.
Really?
A lot of outdoor safety supply stores. RV Parts Canada is available.
Or maybe you just can't order it and have it shipped here.
So it's not available on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least I can't find it on Amazon. But you can buy it directly from the manufacturer. Things are tighter. Like this is an easy, simple buy if you're in a BC.
I go to sale.
There is available sale.
Yeah.
Canadian Tire. It's harder to find here. There's a lot more regulations in the States. You can get it anywhere. If you're in a mountain town out in BC, all these things are more easily available because you've got grizzly bears and mountain lions and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Field tested and proven effective against all types of bears by the Elmendorf Air Force Base and Brown Bear Resources. So when you go through all of this, at some point you have to think this goes beyond just bears and mountain lions. What else out there is going to get you? Have you ever tried a little snake coming at you and give him a squirt with that?
No.
Why not?
But Well, see, I don't
think... He opens his mouth to bite you and show his teeth right down the old gob.
If I was in the States somewhere in the desert area, I might find that, oh, look at that snake, he's coming at me. Maybe, yes. I don't know what would it do to a snake. Would a snake even notice?
I don't know. I don't know. Big moose come charging at moose, you, give him a squirt.
A very angry Canada goose.
Right?
Cobra chicken.
Yeah. So I don't know why they need to put like all these different animals on it.
Yeah.
Just say animal be gone.
Animal repellent. is there a squirrel that's harassing you that's very dangerous?
Right?
That's a rabbit squirrel.
It is a personal preference if you decide to carry bear spray with you. I know there's a lot of people, why would you carry bear spray? Really?
Like, it really depends on where you're hiking.
Where you're hiking, camping. Yeah.
Like here in Ontario, maybe not so much. Like there's a few instances maybe with predatory bears, which is very rare.
Yeah.
Out in BC with grizzly bears, this is a serious concern. People yep. need to carry these things. One of my nieces, she is going out to Revelstoke on Wednesday. She's got a contract work at the summer. She tried to get a job planting trees, couldn't get it, but she's just going to go work in Revelstoke. And one of the things they were told is like, hey, if you leave anywhere to go hiking, you must carry bear spray. It's not a, hey, you should. Where she's going in Revelstoke, they're told, you must carry bear spray.
She needs to get this because it'll cover mountain lions, too.
She'll have to buy it out there. She can't fly with it.
There are those that say it's useless, but if it helps you to have it, then take it.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you know the safety protocols for using it.
Well, for
and
one...
And where the wind is.
That's what I was just going to say. Make sure it's spraying downstream. If you're downstream of the bear, downwind, it's just coming back at you.
Right? And that's what happens. There's people that have had bears outside their tent, and they're trying to get into the tent, so they spray, and they fill the tent with this stuff, and the bear's going,
hey,
oh, that's stinky.
The bear's going to go, spiced up.
that's the one that's spicy meat the ball.
I'll let that guy marinate for a bit. I'll come back in an hour.
Yeah, it's not a joke spray, so be very careful with it.
Dangerous.
No practical jokes.
No.
This isn't Jackass.
Yeah, don't spray people.
But yeah, like I say, make sure you know where that wind direction is and be very careful with it. But even like I say, there's people, I have a can. I brought it on a few solo trips when I first started. And now it's just, I'll just leave it. I don't even bring it anymore. It's probably expired. I think they expire, don't they?
Everything. If you're a manufacturer and you want to make money, everything expires.
Yeah, good point. But yeah, I haven't had it in outdoors in ages.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember. Did I take it when we were doing some of the bigger hikes in the spring?
Yeah.
In the fall.
I've never tripped with bear spray. I've never done it. But then again, Ontario is relatively safe.
Well, and that's exactly it. And we've been out into the Rockies and stuff like that with the grizzlies and stuff. So, I've never heard of anybody using one on a polar bear.
Well, I imagine those things are so predatory. Like humans are a food source for polar bears.
Yeah.
Like it's just not, the polar bear is not angry.
The only thing
he just wants to eat you.
Yeah. The only thing we found was the can of bear spray in a glove.
Yes, and that was it.
But no, so yeah, if you're going to use it, and for some people, it's just that extra safety thing while they're out there, like to make them feel secure, more confident being out. And if it does that for you, take it.
And odds
on. If people want to joke about you taking bear spray,
whatever.
Show them why you take it. Just pull that pin there.
No, don't. But, you know, if it gives you the comfort, the odds of you becoming a statistic for predatory bear attack, it's going to be so rare.
Yeah.
So rare.
But until you get that mindset going.
Yeah.
Take it with you. Have it on your pack. Yeah. Have it on your belt.
Like a time anywhere is like in Ontario would be spring when mama bear's out with baby cubs. She's very protective.
Yep.
If you're out and you come across a moose with a baby moose, they're very protective. So spring with new babies, it's a time where there's higher elevated risks. Or in the fall with rutting moose. Moose in the fall are very angry at people.
Well, and you come across a raspberry bush And then up pops a raspberry.
A
bear eating raspberries.
Yeah.
Like, oh, hello.
I'll go to this patch over here. Yeah. You keep eating.
Oh, don't mind me.
But yeah, so,
I just, I don't know. It just seemed weird when it said, not only bear, but mountain lion.
I know.
Well, no, realistically, everything.
Yes. But they're catering to a certain dangerous predatory animal.
Yeah. Yeah, the mountain lion, the lynx, the tiger.
Is like when I lived out in BC, we heard reports all the time of mountain lions attacking people and people fighting them off with, like, you know, pocket knives and whatever. People getting the skin stripped off their faces because of the mountain lion got surprised by the human. But you know what? Out in BC, it's become common for people to find that they're being tracked and hunted by mountain lions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
uncommon. Well, you don't hear them. They're quiet. They're small.
They're very quiet. Suddenly you hear a crack in the woods. Like, oh, what was that?
I think it's a squirrel or something.
You might catch a glimpse of it in the... It's like, whoa.
Well, it's like lynx, too, right? Here.
Yep. Yep.
Lynx or bobcat, if you want to call it a bobcat.
They're less likely to attack unless they get surprised or cornered.
But then all of a sudden, like, you have no clue they're there.
Oh, no. Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. You're just being watched.
And they're all thinking, I could take you right now.
Like here for mountain lions and bobcat and lynx and whatever, it's like if you're paranoid in the woods, maybe you're sensing something.
Mm-hmm. If you feel like there's something in the woods watching you, chances are there's maybe something in the woods watching you.
Yeah. And we're freaking a whole bunch of people out right now.
Right?
They're all going, well, you don't
have to worry about it when you're on a canoe trip until you're on the portage.
Or in your tent, in your burrito sack.
In your burrito sack, right. Ooh, look, sausage rolls.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, you know what? If you feel the need for it, take it. Be very careful with it. Make sure it's guarded at all times. You know where it is and that sort of deal. And
yeah.
Like I say, read the cans. Follow the rules. Watch the videos on YouTube on how to do it properly, because if it comes down to it and you use it wrong.
Exactly. You're just,
like I say, 6 to 7 seconds of spray.
Mm-hmm. You're going to run out. And if you get yourself, then you're blind yourself.
Yep.
And you can't even see the bear that's about to come.
You know you're getting eaten. You just can't see them.
Exactly.
So. Mississippi solo speed record.
Ah, yes.
It has fallen. And I couldn't find what the old record was. So it only took 2 days until Ilya Smirnov realized the enormity, danger, and borderline foolishness of paddling the entire Mississippi River by himself. An awareness that struck in the icy waters of Minnesota, far from help in his lonely canoe. His dread built to a small breakdown on day 5. When he dragged his 18-foot boat, nicknamed Uncomfortable, over a steep portage that lasted nearly half a mile. Grasping that he hasn't yet reached Twin Cities, let alone New Orleans. Panic reached full volume on day 15.
Day 15.
When Smirnov paddled face first into a 20-mile-per-hour wind from daybreak to sunset. Gritting his teeth while whitecaps crashed around him, it literally was like ripping my soul to pieces, says Smirnov, 42. Back home in Harnett County, is where he's from, he says, it was full-on fight. The Mississippi did not want to give it to me. With grit and meditation and a diet rich in chia seeds.
I can see where his problem is.
Chia seeds?
He's trying to do this on meditation and chia seeds.
Right. Smirnov finished all 2,350 miles of the river in just 34 days. World record now being verified by Guinness. In a month on the river, he witnessed the United States at its most pristine, paddling the headwaters with a squadron of 100 pelicans, watching otters and muskrats play on the shore. On the same trip, he saw the country at its most corrupted, passing industrial hulks with flaming smokestacks along the 18-mile stretch of Louisiana known as Cancer Alley.
Oh, nice.
From north to south, he paddled 15 hours a day, stopping to catch fitful rest in a tent he pitched by the riverside, then heading back out before dawn. This regimen required him to let everything go but the strokes ahead. It was just on one side of my mind all the time, he said. Holy crap, I cannot hold myself emotionally from all the pressures, all that's happening, and this absurd physical demand, and all this exhaustion. And then my mind was like, you can do whatever you want to do, and we'll just keep paddling. That's a fight with that sort of thing.
Yeah,
you're
doing
big trips like that. Especially half you go, I'm like, oh, forget it, I'm done. Yeah. And their half's going, hey, just think.
Yeah.
Can we get all this done?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, especially with solo paddling.
Yeah, you're not, there's nobody there to talk you through stuff or to just have somebody to talk to and bounce stuff off of.
Mm-hmm. And get in a fight with, and then the silent treatment for the next 4 hours.
For the rest of the day, we're solo paddlers.
Right?
But we're in the same boat.
Smirnov came to North Carolina from Russia as a teenager, studying at UNC Asheville, then working as a computer programmer until he and his wife, Megan, wanted a different life. In a Craigslist ad, they found a canoe outfitter for sale along Cape Fear River in Lillington. So they launched into a new life with children and a drastically different form of income. He didn't know the difference between a kayak and a canoe at the time, says his friend Elton Tuning. From the Carolina Canoe Club. He since learned the difference. Smirnov learned paddling the fiercest whitewater around the Gauley in West Virginia, the Grand Canyon, but the Mississippi beckoned, running the length of the country. Carrying so many of its stories, he ordered road maps from every state it touched, taped them together on a wall, making a long blue line his next big goal. It's so American, he said. Those who've never seen it imagine the Mississippi as lazy, bucolic, fit for river travel by raft. But Smirnov traveled through 26 locks and dams, calling ahead by marine radio so the lock master could let him through. He paddled alongside hundreds of barges, sometimes 8 of them lashed together, a hazard that always threatened to suck him under or capsize him with wakes the size of ocean waves. He called their captains by radio too, warning them to watch out for a tiny boat up ahead. Then by the time he reached New Orleans, he met up with ferocious storms that forced him to park his canoe on the rocks and wait. Spent a night beneath a sheet of canvas covering his canoe, riding out the storm with mosquitoes and cockroaches. There's a new one for you. Up until the last mile, Smirnov questioned whether he'd reached mile zero. Every day the Mississippi would throw something at me that was completely out of whack, totally unexpected, he says. It really feels like a turbulent sea with waves everywhere. I'm just a little guy in a canoe. It was full on. Back home, Smirnov prepares a package full of documentation for the Guinness people, a process he expects to take months. But if you Google record holder, they've got him down as already.
Yeah. Okay.
People ask if he lost weight, and he tells them that he had very little fat to lose after training 3 to 6 days a week, even consuming 5,000 calories a day. And I know you're big on this sort of thing.
Mm.
Supplied by his ground crew on the river, Smirnov burned all available fuel. Among the endless things he gained is the knowledge of how to find a personal breaking point and push past it. How to float past the world with all its callous indifference and still enjoy the spectacles that swim past mile after mile.
Hmm.
Yeah, pretty cool.
It is cool. And like you say, I'm sort of, I focus on the calorie part of it. But it's one of the things, if you don't fuel yourself, you just, without fuel, you just can't do it.
Yep.
And so we've seen a lot of examples of people on loan, like Kylan, where she was consuming large amounts of olive oil and just to gain body fat because she knew she was going to lose body fat.
Yep.
So to survive something like that and to do this kind of paddling, 15-hour days, you have to consume a lot. A lot. Otherwise, you're just going to, the tank's going to be empty, you're going to lose too much weight, and you're going to fail.
Yeah. No, you got to know where that line is, too.
Yeah, yes, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Because there's nothing like paddling 2,300 miles and then, Yeah, I gained 40 pounds.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Wait a minute.
How'd you do that?
Right? So, yeah, congratulations.
Yes.
Pretty cool.
Good for him.
So now, 34 days. Who's going to do it in
34 days? 30. Is that what the total was?
Mm-hmm. So now it's got to go 30 should be the next sort of milestone.
Yeah.
Make it an even month. What are you doing next month?
No way. Not
no way. It's a big river. Like, have you ever seen, because we were down there and looking at it, and it was just like,
yeah,
I don't know that I'd want to do it. It'd be cool to get out there and paddle, but
it would be, but it's a very dangerous river. There's the problem is
it's a working river.
It's work. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I was going to say. It's a working river. There's a lot of tugs and barges and whatnot. And so it's not logistically, but it's also safety involved that you have to really focus and pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Who are the two old guys that were competing back and forth for?
Oh, Dale Graybeard Saunders.
Yeah, and they were
I
in
can't remember what
40 days or something. They were up there.
Yeah, but this guy, he's 82 now.
Yeah,
something like that.
Yeah. He has a record for fastest oldest person.
Mm-hmm. For now.
He still has it. Yeah, for now.
For now. Yeah. For now. Till his buddy takes it from
him.
That's a good rivalry though.
Yes.
That's a good rivalry. Fun. But as much as I'd like to paddle the Mississippi, I don't think I'd want to try to speed the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to do it for the race. I would do it for the experience.
I would do the full Mississippi if all of a sudden I won enough money to retire.
Yes.
Yeah. I won the lottery. I'm retiring. Yeah. I'm taking my boat down to the Mississippi. Who wants to come with? And I would have... Okay, here's an RV. I'll rent you an RV.
Mm-hmm.
You just make sure I got the food.
Yeah.
You meet up with me once a week or twice a week or something like that. Pass off the food.
Well, like that couple that drive around New Zealand? Or is it Norway? It was Norway. We talked about them last week or the week before. He was like sometimes like a kilometer out in the ocean.
Oh, yeah.
And she'd ride along in the little
New Zealand.
RV minivan thing.
Yeah.
So that'd be fun.
Right? And meet up every twice a week, maybe?
Yeah.
Resupply, that sort of thing?
I'd do the minivan part or the camper part. I could read a book, hang out, wait for my wife or
read
something.
Read a book, you liar.
I read books.
Comic books.
Graphic novels, thank you very much.
I don't play with dolls. They're action figures. I found an article from Adirondack Almanac. Jen Wolchin explored Louis Lake and the legacy of French Louis.
French Louis. What is his real name?
French Louis.
Because it's Louis Lake.
Oh, but not the same.
And he's French.
It's not. They don't think it's named after
French Louis. No, but there's got to be something there.
Well, French Louis was a legendary outdoorsman in the rural Adirondacks in the 1800s. So if you Google the story, you're going to go down a rabbit hole, I'm thinking here.
I'm about to start that now.
In the 1800s, a Canadian-born woodsman traveled south to seek his fortune as a hunter, trapper, lumberjack. His adventures ultimately led him to the horse-propelled stagecoach from North Creek to Indian Lake in the Adirondack Mountains. French Louis, as he became known over the years, spent months in the woods only to come out to sell his bounty of fur, fish, leather, and whatever he could trade for food, supplies, and liquor. Over the years, he became famous for being known as a rugged woodsman who loved to entertain the local townspeople with his charm and wit. Louis worked for many years at lumber camps near Louis Lake. And so his name, Louie, as opposed to Louis Lake, Lewey.
I found his real name.
Don't tell me.
Okay.
Just southwest of Indian Lake. What's his real name?
His name is Louis Seymour.
Louis Seymour.
That's according to Wikipedia.
Ah, what is Wikipedia?
Famous late 19th century wilderness guide, trapper, and folk hero who lived in southern Adirondacks of New York.
Mm-hmm. French Louis had several camps in the Adirondack backwoods over the years. Some of the camps were located in the West Canada wilderness or further west near Cedar Lake. French Louis constructed a few cabins, including a shanty next to a huge cave. When he left the woods to bring his bounty to town, Louis usually headed to Newton's Corner, known today as Speculator. Citizens of Speculator grew to love his witty and fun-loving personality. Although he lived in the woods for long periods of time, Louis endeared himself to the people of the towns he visited. Today, Louis Lake is a New York State campground offering swimming, fishing, camping, and paddling on the lake's northeastern shore. East shore of the lake is dotted with beautiful waterfront camping sites, but the west shore of the lake is mostly undeveloped. As far as we know, Louis Lake was not named after French Louis.
I think the name of the lake came first, but he was just, his name is Louis, he's French, so they called him French Louis, and Louis Seymour is his real name, his true name. There's a restaurant named after him.
Is it really?
Yeah, French Louis.
Oh. You can explore the south end of Louis Lake to see if you can find where the Miami River enters the lake. River meanders south into the wild and untamed West Canada Lake wilderness, where French Louis maintained several camps over the years. So that was like his personal little highway, was Miami River. As we plunged our canoes into the water, says Woltjen, I stepped into the cool water and felt a rush of natural air conditioning on my feet and lower legs. That'd be cold water. The beach here is nice enough for a post-paddle swim, I remind myself, or I could just sit down on the shallow end and feel the cool water rush over my lower body. A possibility. So this is their trip. They found the went up the Miami River trying to find some of the places French Louis was. We paddle for about 45 minutes to reach the end of the lake. As we approach the end of the lake, I look for any kind of opening that could be the start of the Miami River. Marshy grasses make it difficult to see an opening, but a little feathered friend shows up and leads the way. Although the water has some ripples, the current is not strong. I can easily place my paddle blade in the water, push the canoe quietly along. The only sounds I hear are the rippling of the water and some water birds rustling in the weeds. Just my kind of noise. As we venture further into the Miami River, the river starts to narrow. We can see a lot of beaver dam activity along the way. Just what I had feared, we paddled up to a huge beaver dam spanning the entire width of the river. We review the size and depth of the beaver dam to determine our choices. We need to make a decision, either get out and try to climb over the dam and haul our canoes over the thick, sticky dam, or turn around and head back. We're not sure if we could find a good spot to get out of our canoes. The water is deep. Also, we wanted time to explore the western side of the Louis Lake on our paddle back. Decision was made to head back. So now we got to go figure it out ourselves. Start back, we're treated to stunning views of the snowy mountain range in the distance. So if you look at Miami River and Louis Lake and stuff, just the scenery there.
Yeah.
Like, that is a place to go paddle.
It's nice.
It is really
nice. And it's about a two-hour drive southwest of Lake Placid, if anybody's wondering where it is.
We emerge from the river to re-enter the lake. The wind starts to pick up, forcing us to paddle a little bit harder. We make a wise decision to head to the western side of the lake to hopefully avoid the wind. Hard paddle back most of the way across the lake makes us appreciate the serene waters of the Miami River. The spirit of French Louis lives on in Speculator. He died February 28, 1915. The story is that he became ill and was able to trek to Speculator on February 27th. He got a room at Brooks Hotel by paying for it with a trout he had caught.
I laugh at that. It's like, yeah, how much for the room? One trout, please.
Alrighty. He died the next day. Because he was penniless, local townspeople chipped in and helped pay for his burial in a unmarked grave in the town cemetery. In 1945, so that was 1915, 1945, 30 years later, a group of people who were fascinated with his life history raised enough money to erect a tombstone. The tombstone was not placed until 1954, 9 years later. Over the years, visitors have left coins and memorabilia. On the 100th anniversary of French Louis' death in 2015, the following words were proclaimed by the Herkimer County Legislature. In memory of French Louis this day, I will get up early, refuse to bathe, cook my breakfast in bear or bacon grease, put homemade maple syrup on it, whatever it is. Let my dog clean the dishes. Yeah, I'm not allowed to do that here.
Not anymore.
Go outside and enjoy the day. Howl like a wolf, screech like a panther, or warble like a loon at the top of my lungs. Buy a drink for everyone in the house, and soda is okay. Watch the sunset. Adirondack French Louis by Harvey Dunham is on a list of recommended adventure books at bookshop.org. If you find yourself down at Louis Lake and want to go exploring, Miami River sounds like a really good place to go paddling.
A few beaver dams, but whatever.
You can get over those. If you got a day or so, absolutely. You plan it, you know it's coming. Make a day of it. Go over some of those beaver dams. Mm-hmm. You never know what you might find. It'd be interesting to see how much of his stuff is still there along the rivers.
Yeah. So I imagine most of it would be gone. Like they said, he built several cabins in the area.
Mm-hmm.
He had a cave cabin type thing. He had a cabin by cave, whatever. Anyways, it's interesting if you think about the area and if you could be interesting to walk through the area and determine where the cabins might have been back in the day.
Right.
Because we do that every time we go, every time I go into Algonquin Park, if it's near one of the old prisoner of war camps, I look for debris and stuff.
Or old lumber camps, ranger cabins. Or
the alligators that they've abandoned. Yep. And it's always interesting to kind of see history.
Yeah.
Which is why you should never take it. Not only is it's illegal, but it's nice for the next person that comes along and can see that chunk of alligator, that gear, that cog, that anchor on the island or whatever, right?
Now, the alligators we're talking about aren't the animals. They're the big warping tugs that would
haul logs. Yeah, sorry. In our area, we call it's like a boat, and the boat that runs on the ground, they call it an alligator.
Yeah, it could haul itself over portages and stuff.
And use it to drag logs out of the forest and into lakes so they can, back in the 1800s, early 1900s, they could wash the logs down the river for you know, using the wood.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yeah. Cool. French Louis. Mm-hmm. Who knew? So all these little characters out there.
Lewis Seymour.
Just all of a sudden come out of the woodwork.
Mm-hmm.
Friday, June 26th is getting close.
Oh, it's coming up.
National Canoe Day. National Canoe Day in Canada is celebrated annually on June 26th. Established by the Canadian Canoe Museum in 2007 following a CBC campaign that named the canoe as one of the seven wonders of Canada.
As it should be.
Celebrating the vessel's massive cultural and historical significance. The Canadian Canoe Museum in Peterborough, known as Canoe Capital of the World, traditionally hosts full day of events. You can check the Canadian Canoe Museum events for the latest schedule, which typically features Voyageur canoe tours, museum exhibits, and builder demonstrations. Get on the water and plan a local paddling trip to connect with Canada's waterways. June 26th. It's mm-hmm. a Friday. I should take that day off.
There you go.
Again.
We go up, visit the Canoe Museum. Right. You know, I'd be interested. I've got a 1954 Peterborough canoe built in Peterborough, Ontario. I'd love to get an expert to look at it and see if it's a significant build. It's probably not a significant build. It's just a common build back in the day. But I don't know. I find it interesting that I've got such an old canoe.
Is it still floatable or does it need work?
It's still floatable, but of course it does need refinishing. Some of the paint is starting to chip and peel off, but it's a cedar strip, or a cedar panel canvas with the ribs and all that stuff. It's a really
good. You should get
it done. I have looked into it over the years. It's only getting more expensive, but when I first got it, it was going to be about $2,000 to refinish. I think now, at this point, it might cost about $3,000 to refinish. Which would be interesting, but it's
you
just...
You can buy a new used one.
Yeah, so it's one of those things. Unless it's historically significant or it means something to
you know
it's
what?
Hard to spend that money.
Mikey needs
a winter project.
A winter project. Yeah.
It does. It could use a new layer of canvas.
See,
it's got everything that it's not missing anything. It's got all the parts and pieces, but it's just getting older.
Give it to Mike. Mikey Burns, you're listening to this. I know you're listening to this. Do you want a project for next winter? Derek has a cedar strip canoe that needs some redoing.
Yep.
Yeah. If you're up to the challenge, Mikey, call Derek. I want nothing to do with it.
He's going to email me tomorrow.
He's going to email you, yep. So, yeah, National Canoe Day, Friday, June 26th. I think this is the last thing I got here. No, I got two things. I might as well go over to the last one first. Talking about things coming up. Lock and paddle events.
Yes.
Reminder that lock and paddle events are coming soon. Lachine Canal, Montreal is Saturday, July 11th. Peterborough Lift Lock, Peterborough, Saturday, July 18th. And the Rideau Canal in Ottawa, Saturday, August 15th. For info on the events, like directions, parking, launch points, times, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you can go to parks.canada.ca and just there's a little search bar at the top, type in lock and paddle and you'll find the information there, for whichever one you want to go to. So yeah, parks.canada.ca, lock and paddle events coming up in July and August. The last thing I got here, I've seen this video like about 20 times. Bruce the dog. Like I said, you've probably seen it or come across the story at least.
I've heard about it myself.
A wet and exhausted dog was rescued 4 kilometers off the English coast after being blown away on an inflatable kayak. After floating for 2 cold hours in the North Sea, the dog named Bruce was hauled on board a sightseeing boat near the Farne Islands. Jimmy Reed, who manned the boat from Serenity Farne Island Boat Tours, can be seen in an online video petting the shaggy dog, saying, "You are the goodest of boys." Rescue operation was touch and go, according to the blog post on the sightseeing operator's Facebook page. Crew member Aaron lunged forward, grabbing the dog by the scruff of its neck as it disappeared beneath the water. Force nearly pulled him overboard. His body slipped over the edge of the vessel with only 1 foot hooked around the doorway, keeping him attached to the boat. Wasn't the North Sea where the Titanic sank?
No.
No? Okay. I'm just thinking...
North Atlantic.
North Atlantic,
near Sable Island.
Thinking of Rose and what's-his-face on the door.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Seeing the danger immediately, Jimmy grabbed hold of Aaron's leg. For a few heart-stopping seconds, man, dog, and rescuer were all hanging precariously above the sea. Bruce's owner had been paddling with his dog when strong winds, spurred by changing tides, caught them off guard. Kayak was blown away with Bruce on board. After attempting to swim after the dog, Bruce's owner realized he wouldn't be able to catch up and instead called for help. Reed said the dog was absolutely hypothermic and shivering when the crew found him. Water temperature was around 8 degrees Celsius. Luckily enough, Bruce perked up soon after being wrapped in warm blankets, and by the time he was back on shore, he was ready to go. If you go online, just Google Bruce the dog.
Yeah, lots of videos.
Farne Islands. There's lots of videos of seeing him in this. Yeah, he's just sitting there, and there's boats coming up, and the waves are getting bigger, and he's just in this blue... inflatable kayak.
He's still on the kayak.
Yeah, he's still on the kayak. But there's water and everything in it, so he's soaked and whatnot. And lucky dog. Lucky dog. But that's how fast it happens, man.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's all I got this week.
I've got nothing to add.
You got nothing. Oh, why? Because you were out gallivanting on your motorcycle across?
No.
Yeah, whatever.
Hey, I just let your dog out to pee.
Could have been down here. I don't care. There's litter boxes right there.
She was whining to get out of the basement, out of the recording studio.
Yeah, she wants out of the recording studio. Some days she sits down here all the time. Other days she makes it through half.
Yeah.
Other days she doesn't even come down.
And once in a while we even get visits by the cats.
Right? The HR department.
Mm-hmm.
All righty. Well, if you want to find out more about us, you can go to our website at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And you can stream or download all our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Player FM, Podbean, Amazon Music, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or you can just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com, and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.